Well, first of all, can you hear me? I want to thank you very much for inviting me. I'd like to thank the Black Members Council and the NUDA and the Guardian who sponsored it. When I said to someone at the Guardian that I was doing a speech about what's so great about integration, they said, not this whole website and editorial. I had to put them at their ease and say, no, there are other kinds of integration that are being discussed at the moment beyond the four walls of 119 found in Rome. When I arrived on Friday morning back in England, and I must say, to be honest, I looked at my ticket when I arrived, got the papers, and there was Jack Straw talking about the veil, and then there was rioting and clashes in Windsor, and then there was this foray over a Muslim policeman in whether he should or shouldn't defend the Israeli embassy. And I wondered, my ticket said Heathrow, and I thought I'd landed in the 1950s, and it really did. The kind of the speed from afar, the speed at which so much of the national conversation has degraded, has really taken my breath away. And it's easy to throw insults around about why that might be. And one of the obvious, you know, places to look at is 9/11, but actually it was going downhill before then. We had the uprisings in Bradford and all of the bad things that came out of that. The BNP were already doing quite well before September 11th. Issues of fundamentalism had already been raised before Iraq. And so in many, many ways, and Blunkett had already started this kind of downward spiral where the Home Office Minister feels the need to sound like a radio call-in guy to some kind of, you know, to some radio show and kind of talk about political correctness, this, and kind of, you know, in our country we will do this, and so on. The speed at which it's degraded has been alarming, although to place it in just one particular place and to leave out others, I think, would be a mistake. And nonetheless, I'm going to try and chart some of that and to look at really this holy grail that is mentioned, which is integration, and really try and unpack what that might mean. And I want to start by paying my own tribute to Claudia Jones and tell you a little bit about her. Claudia Jones, for those don't know, was a Trinidadian communist who came to London via Harlem courtesy of Joseph McCarthy, the red-baiting American senator. And Claudia, who set up the West Indian Gazette, died young. This is what Corinna Skinner Carter, who was one of Claudia's closest friends, said. Claudia was full of energy, so full of energy she exhausted everyone, including herself. She used to chain smoke, but I never saw her actually finish a cigarette, and she talked like she smoked. Now, Claudia soldiered on through the 50s at a time that was incredibly hostile. And on August the 18th, 58, the Klan, British chapter of the Klan, sent her a letter at the West Indian Gazette addressed to my dear Mr. B. Ape, saying that we, the Aryan Knights, miss nothing. Close attention has been paid to every issue of this rag, and I do sincerely assure you the information gleaned has proven of great value to the Klan. Now, I say that because Claudia, for much of the time, although there was community and there was movement, Claudia, for much of the time, was really kind of out there on her own, making both waves and space. And at the beginning of this, I want to dwell on that because I feel that I am part of a kind of a generational moment now in the history of Black Britons, where there is, on one level, a limited amount of space, more space than there certainly has been before. There's space on the bookshelves for a variety of non-white writers that there wasn't before. There's space in newspapers that there wasn't before. Space on television, space in Parliament. Now, not enough space, the space is limited, but it does exist. And there is a temptation, which I absolutely understand, to claim that space as though it were acquired by our merits alone. And that doesn't mean that those people who occupy that space don't have merits, but merits alone would never have been sufficient. That struggle provided that space for us. and it gave voice to whatever merits we had. And that there are people like Claudia and other members, some of whom are here, older black people who never even knew what name we would carry, but who paid for us already. And whenever we get the chance, we, I feel, have to acknowledge that, because otherwise it's like we somehow we have the merits that other people didn't. They always had the merits, but they never had the space. But secondly, I want to talk about something that is really kind of about Claudia that really is pertinent, very pertinent to the subject at hand, because Claudia's, probably Claudia's most enduring and famous legacy, for those who don't know, was the Notting Hill Carnival. That Claudia was primarily responsible for the beginning of the Notting Hill Carnival. And that carnival, which is now lauded in Britain as a shining emblem of this country's racial tolerance and its ability to kind of understand and integrate, was the product not of any innate sense of British fair play, but resistance. 2 weeks after she received those letters from the British chapter of the Klan, Teddy Boys in Notting Hill went on a nigger hunting expedition, and they looked for black men to beat up. And Jones decided that the appropriate response to this challenge to our right to live here in peace was to throw a carnival. It wasn't originally in Notting Hill, it was originally inside, actually, in St. Pancras. But the idea was to make a cultural response to a political problem and to show, to assert our presence in our own language and to sing our own song. Now, carnival outlived Claudia, and long after she passed, it was adopted by the press to some extent as an annual barometer of race relations in this country. Every year, for years, during carnival, there would be one of two pictures on the front page of the national newspapers on the Sunday or Monday of August bank holiday. It would either be a policeman in a hospital with bandages around their head, or a policeman with a ridiculous, core-blinded look on his face, hugging some reveler in full costume. And throughout the 70s and 80s, it really, as well as being presented as a barometer of national race relations, was actually a barometer of racism in the British press. In 1977, The Express showed a picture of young black men lined up and sizing themselves up against a group of police opposite, and the front page piece read, "War Cry." The unprecedented scenes in the darkness of London streets looked and sounded like something out of the film classic Zulu. Then there was The Mail on August 31st, 1977. "If the West Indians want to preserve what should be a happy celebration, which gives free rein to their natural exuberance, vitality, and joy," we did bring something to it, "it is up to their leaders to take steps necessary to ensure its survival." The Telegraph just blamed black people for being here in the first place. "Many observers warned from the outset," wrote the Telegraph, "that mass immigration from poor countries of substantially different culture would generate enmity, alienation, delinquency, and worse." And for me, reading over some of those comments, they begin to sound slightly familiar to some of the things that we're hearing now. And the calls for banning the carnival were routine, that almost every year, the cry would go up to stop this, and that this was a terrible, we've tolerated this enough and it can't go on and it's only going to end in disaster. But it continued. And today it's almost, I say almost, almost a banal fact of life, a fixture in the summer bank holiday, and one example that people give of why and how Britain is tolerant, how Britain is diverse, how the British fair play is touted as a fact. But actually, if you know how we got there, if you know what Claudia had to do to get it, if you know what it was the product of, then you see that these things, this diversity, this integration that we take for granted, is not the product of some abstract, mythological, great British decency. That principle to barrier to integration in this country has been, and unfortunately remains, racism. And that racial harmony, such that it exists, or has ever existed in Britain, has existed as a result of anti-racist struggle. But it doesn't come from the goodness of anybody's heart or any latent sense of fair play. It was fought for by ordinary people, black and white, and it was won. And that also means that it can be lost. So the title's What's Great About Integration, so I want to start by talking about the things that I genuinely think are great about integration. Because, you know, as far as it goes, integration is a wonderful thing. And common sense suggests that the more contact you have with different races, religions, and ethnicities, the less potential there is for stereotyping and dehumanizing people who are different from yourself. I arrived on Friday, as I said, and the papers on Friday and then on Saturday spoke of this kind of almost feverishness that you thought that was sweeping the country, that kind of, you know, that Britain was racked by some kind of amazing sense of self-doubt and internal division and so on. And then Sunday I was in the East End. And I was kind of, the whole time this was on my mind, and the speech was on my mind, and I'm looking around for signs of this fragile sense of self. And what I see, what I saw, were belly buttons, and pierced belly buttons, and devout Bengalis, and bagels, and biryanis, and nipple rings, and even niqabs, all walking down the street, seemingly, to some extent, simply coexisting, but coexisting in a way that seemed to me to kind of be working fairly well. And actually, each time I come back, I feel like I'm experiencing another relatively new phenomenon, which is the large numbers of people from mainland Europe that make Britain, when I left, I felt that Britain was a post-colonial city. London was a post-colonial city. Now, increasingly when I come back, I feel like it's a global city. And that I've stopped imagining, particularly in the service industry, I've stopped assuming that white people speak English, because it simply isn't an effective way of engaging in my life. And actually, I find that very exciting. And one of the things that was kind of disappointing, well, there were many, about Ruth Kelly's open and honest, frank discussion, was when she felt the need to say, you know, that there are people who look around where they live and they wonder how things have changed. And yes, I'm going to say it, white people. And I thought, well, actually, you know, in many of these communities, if you go down to Brixton or you go to Liverpool or you go to Bristol, that many of these places have black communities that have been there for generations, if not centuries. And they too find many of these changes troubling and disturbing. And then you have to make the decision, are you going to inflame those fears? Are you going to support those fears? Or are you going to try and assuage those fears with talk of how people come together and not rather than how you are going to split them up? But all of this stuff is what I love about London. That's what I love about cities. I love the mix. And here in London, I think we have a better mix than most. And when you see the relative ease of presence, it's difficult to understand what you read from afar about the panic of multiculturalism. Now, I want to say a little bit about multiculturalism here. I will come back to it, but it does feel to me a bit like political correctness, multiculturalism. Multiculturalism at the moment in Britain seems to be whatever you want it to be, so long as you don't like it. And for some people, and I think actually for more people than would like to admit it, multiculturalism actually means the existence of a variety of cultures in Britain. That it's become the shorthand, even for that. In the same way that political correctness became the shorthand for women in parliament at some stage. Political correctness has become the shorthand for anti-racism. Anything you don't like, just call it political correctness and then you can get on with it. It's the same with multiculturalism. So half the time I feel like I don't really understand what these people are talking about, and the trouble is, if I'm honest with myself, I do understand what they're talking about. Mm-hmm. They're talking about black people, non-white people, and they don't want us here. And that, but the trouble for those people, and it's been a trouble that's long been around for them, is that battle has been fought, and we won. That we're here to stay. There's no question now. You can't, if you try and unpick the racial fabric of Britain, the whole thing falls apart. All of your cities fall apart. your football team falls apart, your CD rack is empty, your bookshelf is destroyed, your television screen is blank. It's this multiculturalism that made Ali G and the Three Golden Moms and goodness gracious me. It's driving our trains and our buses, it heals our wounds in hospitals, it plays in our crash, and it wins medals on the track and field. Sadly, it's also populating our prisons, our unemployment lines, and our mental institutions, and I'm going to come to that too. But there's no going back on this, much though some people would like that to happen. So to a large extent, for many of these people in this country, integration is just a fact of life. And integration, as far as it goes, is great. The trouble is that on its own, it really doesn't go very far. And that's really what I want to spend some time on here tonight. Without the vigorous pursuit of equality and anti-racism, integration just describes a fairly hollow and at times deceptive ease of presence. Lest we forget, Germany was the part of Europe where Jews were most integrated before the Second World War. And as I said earlier, racial stereotype and misunderstanding is great if you don't know people of a different race than if you do. But even that small achievement depends on the quality and power dynamics of the contact. Because integration and subjugation can sit side by side quite easily. Nonetheless, in the last, I would say, 4 or 5 years, integration has been fetishized as an aim all by itself. It's been hailed not only as the answer to our domestic race relations, but as the central plank on the home front of the war on terror. It's been positioned not as complementary to multiculturalism, but as contradictory to it. It's been put forward not as the never-ending process of negotiation into a fluid and ambiguous culture, but a series of finite demands for assimilation into fixed known values. The only trouble is that nobody can agree on what those values really are. Its limit, it appears, are boundless, and its demands are absolute. It's supposed to provide us with an answer, and it's presented as a definitive answer, but I keep coming back to the question, which is, what do we want from this thing that they call integration? What is in it for all of us? Not just black people, but all of us. So I want to take a detour to the American South. I want to take a detour to the American South. In 1948, South Carolina Senator Strom Thurmond broke with the Democratic Party and ran a segregationist campaign for president. Now, all the while, it now turns out, to the amusement of many but a surprise of none, while he was out on the stump banging the drum for segregation, Strom Thurmond was sleeping with black women and had a black daughter. Now this, it seems, was the gentlemanly thing to do in the Deep South. In the 50s, during the campaign for Alabama governor, Jim Folsom went to the Black Belt, which is between Montgomery and Selma, where support for refusing African Americans to vote was greatest. And he pointed out the number of mixed race people that there were in Alabama. And he said, you know, light-skinned people, and he said, I just want you to know that the sun didn't bleach those people. In a later gubernatorial campaign, he asked why white people were getting so worked up about the sacredness of segregation, when it looked to him, he said, as if a whole lot of integrating was going on at night. Black women in the South breastfed and raised white children. If you ever read any memoirs of white Southerners, well, actually, if you read any memoirs of Southerners during the Civil War era, they're always white, because black people weren't allowed to write those books by and large, then the first friend of any of these kind of any of these writers was always the gardener's boy or the field hand boy or whoever, and then it was kind of abruptly cut off, usually somewhere around puberty. Since most slave owners actually weren't that wealthy, most black and white families shared the same roof. So the question was not really integration. The question wasn't whether the races could mix. It was the ground rules for the mixing. These relationships were not consensual or mutual, but coerced and one-sided. The whites' only signs kept African Americans from many a public place. But in the most intimate parts of their lives, black and white people were as integrated as they possibly could be. And that's why I think, you see so much ambivalence in America if you go around the South now and you ask people about integration. That African Americans, they say integration was a bit like the unifying of the two Germanys after the war came down. It was the assimilation of the powerless into the powerful. Black people had to fit into white society, but white society actually made very few concessions to them. And education was a great example. If you looked at, previously there were black schools, and they would, by force, and those schools would have their valedictorians, and they would have the black headmasters, and so on. And everyone who was black had to go to that school in that neighborhood. When integration came, the smartest black students went to the white schools. So the black schools got weaker. And yet the black students who went to the white schools found very few attempts to reflect their history or anything that would make them really feel good about themselves, their identity, or their experience. The best they could expect was to be tolerated, and that was rare. So long as racism has remained prevalent in these communities, blacks have been faced with a choice. Either they integrate into a white society that doesn't want them, or they stick together and make the best of what few resources they have. Now that isn't much of a choice, and it doesn't say much for integration if that's your understanding of integration, if it stops there. So, given that choice, this is what many people have done. According to Gallup in 1997, 71% of African Americans attended most or all black churches. 41% lived in mostly all black neighborhoods. 32% belonged mostly to all black clubs or social organizations. And 25% had their oldest child in a mostly or all black school. And actually, the figures for white people were even higher. The most segregated hour of the week in America is 11 o'clock on a Sunday morning, when black and white people go to different churches and worship the same God. The second most segregated hour is 7 o'clock on any weekday, when they all watch completely different programs on television. Now, these levels of segregation were a gruesome fact of life. And what was sad for me as a Briton coming through in the kind of with the politics that I have, was that some African Americans elevated this to a point of principle. That they would say, the separation is fine. I don't want to eat with them anyway. What I have a problem with is the equal resources. And I felt that that is a depressing and flawed argument. Not least because it builds a fairly romantic notion of how solid the black community was before, and it ignores the fact that the segregation was forced at gunpoint. It wasn't actually something that they chose. The only reason that racial segregation exists is because racism exists. You take racism away, and there's no more point in wanting to live in a black area than there would be in wanting to live in an area where everyone was tall, fat, or had ginger hair. But for weeks, when I was down south, I kept quizzing African Americans and trying to work out why they were buying this. Before I realized that I was asking the wrong question. Charles Payne, an African American lecturer at Duke University in North Carolina, explained to me, he said, the issue for black people was never really integration or segregation, but white supremacy. The paradigm of integration and segregation was a white concern. That was how they posed the issue of civil rights, given their own interests. And that's how the entire issue then became understood. But the central concerns of black people were not whether they could integrate with white people or not, but how to challenge white people's hold on the power structure. Now that hasn't changed yet. And that's why, if you understand what happened as being integration, then everything follows from that, that you would be disappointed in integration. It's not delivering what you asked for. So,
thank you. You sat there with all the time.
So, integration is contingent on whom you're asking to integrate, what you're asking them to integrate into, and on what basis you're asking them to do so. So the framing and the framing of the current debate on those terms is incredibly flawed. So let's first of all look at the facts about who has most trouble integrating. Because the group in Britain, in this great new Britain, that has most trouble fitting in is not Muslims, it's white people. Now, I could use that as a rhetorical device, and I did a column last week, and clearly some people thought it was a rhetorical device, but it's actually true. It's as much as you can have empirical evidence for these kind of things, it's as true as it can be. A YouGov poll for the Commission for Racial Equality last year showed that 83% of whites have no friends with practicing Muslims, only 48% as opposed to 48% of non-white people. 94% of whites, compared with 47% of people from ethnic minorities, said most or all of their friends are white. Now, there's a note of caution here, a clear note of caution, because 90% of the country is white. So, if you factor that in, then there are just less black people to go around. that's why people's hearts are but they do tell you a story. And that story is that it's actually very, very difficult to segregate yourself if you're not white in this country. You're surrounded by white people. I grew up in Stevenage. I went to school, I went to university in Edinburgh. I used to walk around as a young person. This was something that was kind of passed on in my family. I would walk around as a young person. If I saw a black person in Stevenage, I would nod, and they would always nod back, and it was this sense of, I know. And then I went up to Edinburgh and it was exactly the same thing. It was only when I came down to London after 3 days, I was walking around like a nodding dog, looking at me as though I was a freak show, that I realized that the experience that I had was not necessarily the experience that I had to have, but it was a fairly common one. And so when people talk about segregated experience of non-white people, they have to understand that it's actually quite difficult if you're not white to, I mean, I would question why you want to, but it's very difficult if you did want to actually live a life where you didn't know white people. And clearly, from these statistics and from common sense, that's not true for white people. So, if you're not white in this country, you have a problem. Thank you. Thank you very much. The sad thing is that it's clearly, there are many white people who do want to avoid black people. There was a Mori poll for Cross Bay magazine last year that showed that 41% of whites, compared with 26% of ethnic minorities, want the races to live separately. But we also know, I find that figure rather high, I must say. But we also know from anecdotal experience and from the way that certain demographies work, that there has been a move at times where black people have moved into an area and white people have moved out. And that segregation, white flight, I mean, we have a name for it, is a relatively common phenomenon. So if you're looking for people who have trouble with integration, we have to start actually with white people. And that, when I hear these people say we need to have this bold conversation and we need to, at the end of these bold conversations, they always end up picking on people who are the weakest. And they never actually end up, first of all, addressing the real issues, but secondly, really saying anything that would smack to me of being bold or brave. Bold or brave at all. Moreover, it's not just the presence, it's not the presence of black people that causes racism. That is a commonly misunderstood myth. It's actually their absence that nurtures it. According to an Observer investigation in 2005, Devon and Cornwall recorded among the highest number of racial incidents in proportion to the size of its non-white population in the country. The more isolated the black community, it showed in the rural areas, the more likelihood there was of racist abuse. I was in Cornwall last year to do a piece about race in Britain, and was shocked. I just put Cornwall and race in, thinking, you know, I'll just see what's up there on the database, and up came Darkie Day, an annual event in Cornwall that they still have, where groups of Cornish people dress up in blackface and dance down the street with wigs and the full the full regalia. So this is kind of something that I feel is kind of being constantly and sadly missed from the debate about integration. A crucial point. And that's it. It's not the hijab, it's not language lessons, the barrier to integration isn't the niqab, it's not the veil, it's not jihad, that the principal barrier, if you want to know what the principal barrier is to integration in this country, is racism. And that doesn't mean that there isn't anything else going on, but unless we're going to have a conversation about racism, then any conversation about integration is going to implode under the weight of its own omission. That doesn't mean that fundamentalism isn't a problem. It was a problem before September 11th, it was a problem before the war in Iraq, and in many ways it's an even bigger problem now, and it's taken on a murderous form, and we shouldn't indulge it. We shouldn't excuse their anti-Semitism, we shouldn't excuse the homophobia, the misogyny, we shouldn't excuse any of the intolerance, but we need to have a sense of proportion. These people represent a tiny part of a relatively small community in which they are isolated and for the most part loathed. We need not just to condemn them, but we need to fight them. And I believe we have to fight them just as we should the white working class who are attracted to the BNP. We isolate their leadership and we win over their followers. And to do that, we have to come up with a better idea. That would be true for both of them. We have to come up with a better idea that is going to have relevance. But it's difficult. It's difficult to make that case when your arguments are being drowned out by the bombings in Beirut. It's difficult to get people to look past the scenes of Abu Ghraib and to see the bigger picture. That most of these conversations are drowned out by the huge clamor that's taking place elsewhere. And in those times of fear and ignorance, racism will always provide a bigger draw, and bigotry will always provide a bigger draw. And that's why politicians, British politicians, I would say, just like the jihadist leaders, they understand that. And sadly, that's why they appeal to it. Now, I, for one, believe that Jack Straw has the right to raise whatever issue he wants. And we have to be careful, I think, about how we frame our responses to these things, because people always want to come back and say, look, you don't want to have the debate, you don't want to have the discussion, you want to silence us. That everybody asserted the right to offend with Danish cartoons, but nobody would stand up for the right to be offended, for the right of people to say, well, actually, if you have the right to do this, then I at least have the right to call you a racist. There was the most peculiar kind of turn of events in the wake of the Danish cartoon saga, where on the one hand, a group of mostly angry young guys, Muslim guys, came on the street and they had some offensive banners, and there were other things that were also offensive, but offensive banners which people in the name of free speech argued should be removed. And that one of those banners, which wasn't offensive, but it was a banner saying down with free speech, which paradox in both of those positions is pretty striking. What you have to ask about Jack Straw is why then and why now? There are very interesting conversations that we can have about the veil, and have been had. There are kind of myriad of academic papers about it. It's a very interesting issue. It depends, you know, what part of the world you're in as to kind of how that issue is played out. But there are a whole lot of things that Jack Straw could be talking about. And you have to wonder why he decided to concentrate on a piece of clothing worn by a tiny minority of a tiny minority, a relatively small minority. Why have that conversation when there are so many to have? And he knows, he understands, however reasonable he may sound in a Lancashire Evening Telegraph, he knows how that's going to play out. He's a politician, he's not stupid. He knows that there's a context, and he's playing to that context. There's a war on, and he, of all people, should know that because he helped start it. Islamophobia is on the rise, fundamentalism among Muslim youth is on the rise, antagonism between Muslim and white youth is on the rise, and into this battle-scarred racial landscape, Jack Straw very daintily throws this hand grenade. Now, some people said that this was brave, and you only have to look at who had Jack Straw's back to realize how brave this wasn't. That the entire, all of Fleet Street came out in favor of him. That kind of 90% of the people I heard about and heard on radio programs came out supporting him. 90% of Britain coming out talking about this tiny percentage of Muslim women. And you can see how it played out. This quote really made me laugh. This is in Saturday's paper. And it's a view from Blackburn. Daniel Coyne, 16, and white. That's, he could only be white. He said, "I'd go further than Jack Straw and say that they should take off their veils. You need to see people face to face. It's weird not knowing who it is you're passing in the street, especially late at night when someone might jump you." So, now Muslim women are muggers too. I thought that was a reserve of the Afro-Caribbean male. Now they're approaching to our space. So this 16-year-old boy is afraid that a woman in a nigga jumped out and beat him up. In the sun, they have Lila Bague, who travels to Leeds Bradford from France in her burqa, in order to, maybe it was a niqab, in order to make the case that kind of Muslim women, there could be loads of terrorists coming in, and Muslim women could be, it could be a gateway for terrorism. Next day in the Times, suspect in terror hunt used veil to evade arrest. So we've moved from this kind of very genteel and interesting discussion about feminism and multiculturalism and where the space lies between. We've moved from that to Muslim women will beat you up, they will blow you up, they will jump out and beat your head in, even if you're a 16-year-old boy in Black. So that's what happened to Jack Straw's debate. And it wasn't an honest debate. It wasn't an open debate, and it's not helped community relations at all. And if you look, I looked at a poll which showed that I think it's 1 in 4 of 1 in 4 people know. Four in ten, people even know the name of their MP. So the fact that these women are in Jack Straw's office suggests that whatever else is going on in their life is not a parallel life that they're living. They are already engaged in some way. And yet, Jack Straw's first question to these women is, "I don't like the way you look, and I would like you to change the way you dress." And the only reason that Jack Straw could have done that, I believe, is because he's standing for deputy leader. And so Muslims become a signifier. John Reed gets up and says he'll go. He sounds like he was preparing to kind of rally the Kenyan kind of settlers to beat up the Mau Mau. You know, we'll go where we like and when we like and how we like, we'll say what we like. An incredible kind of journey to a previous time, what I thought was a previous time, particularly from a Labour leader. Could you imagine someone like Barbara Castle saying something like that? And Jack Straw feels the need to compete in some level, and so you get a Dutch auction, and who's going to lose? It's not just the Muslims, but our own racial fabric. And even Phil Edwards, the BNP spokesman, said Straw was playing a subtle race card in his bid to broaden his appeal with the white working class. "We've been saying this about Muslim dress for some time," he told the Sunday Express. "It's all part of the problems of a multicultural Britain that he and the Labour Party helped create." So racism is the central barrier, and there's quite a lot of it. But the most likely victims of race attacks are white people. They're Pakistanis and Bangladeshis, the two dominant groups among Muslims. And all of this is compounded with economic deprivation. And Bangladesh has had the highest rate of unemployment, reaching just over 40% for men under 25. These people aren't segregated, they are alienated. As they need to be integrated into anything, it's a real matter of urgency, it's the workforce and the education system. A decent job with a decent income is still the best path out of the crudest forms of racism and fundamentalism. And polls and studies show a link between wealth and a propensity to integrate. So the basis on which people are being told to integrate doesn't feel appealing. The liberal, tolerant democracy that we are asked to integrate into, in fact, doesn't exist. And those most eager to salute it are least likely to defend it. Now, I don't know if any of you saw some of the pieces by a guy called David Goodhart. David Goodhart wrote these series of essays that had members of the liberal intelligentsia quivering with kind of excitement. And it was really what I would call powerism for pointy heads. It was an evocation, really, of, I think, quite a vile form of racism, repackaged and made to look as though it was intellectual and tough and integral, but really, really it wasn't. And one of the quotes that really stands out for me from David Goodhart was claimed that, put bluntly, we really all prefer our own. And I made the question in a piece that I wrote, I said, well, who's our in this? Because the our you're talking about isn't the our I'm talking about. My community, the community that I believe myself to be a part of, doesn't just prefer its own. And to the extent that it has its own is always changing and always trying to envelop new people and communicate with other people. And it's not particularly a black community either, it's a community of values and morals, not of melanin. So they ask, why won't you mix more in this society that won't employ you, that can't educate you, that scapegoats you? And even when you do, as evidenced by the women who come into Jack Straw, there are new demands that come up as well. And this is a real problem right now, that there seems to be no force in British culture, no serious political force that is prepared to tackle racism. I honestly thought that with a huge majority that Labour had, this was something that they could have done. They had a chance. Next time, you know, what they'll be saying is, well, it's very difficult because, you know, we're up against, you know, we could lose power. 1997, they had this huge, huge majority. If this was something that they wanted to do, then they could have done it. And at the last election, I was in Dorset and asked a Labour candidate there who, when asked, you know, when he met racism, and he said it was a big problem because at the end of the day, the Tories would always be better racists than Labour. And he's, you know, so he said it was a real problem on the doorstep, this racism that kind of previous Labour workers kept talking about the asylum and immigration system, and he kept saying to them, well, you know, we're doing our best. And I was like, what do you mean we're doing our best? And he's like, we're doing our best to keep them out. And I said, are you going to address this? Are you, because this is clearly a problem for you. And then he said more about the asylum and immigration. I said, no, I mean, are you going to address the racism? Because unless you do, this is always going to be a problem for you. And he said, you know, and at the end of the day, I would say it's not something that he had thought about, but it wasn't something, clearly wasn't something that he was going to do. There is no serious cultural or political force asking white people to integrate. There's no one who wants to deal with the endemic issues of poverty in the Muslim or the white communities. There's nobody who wants to talk about the war. But everybody wants to talk about the veil, they want to talk about jihad, they want to talk about terrorism, they want to talk about multiculturalism. So we have this skewed discussion. This open and honest debate is anything but honest and anything but open. And then they wonder why Muslims don't want to fit in. And my guess would be, I look at it and I say, well, fit into what? Who wants to fit into a country that puts 8 bullets in the body of a young man in the subway and nobody takes responsibility? Do you want us to fit into a country which wages war against Muslim nations on the basis of preemption and then marches into somebody's house on the basis of presumption and shoots them in the stomach? what country do you want us to fit into? Where is our place in this? Because integration and subjugation do and can work hand in hand. So, you know, I wouldn't be a Guardian columnist if I were to suggest any solutions to this. But I do want to talk about some of the things that I think we need to tackle in some way. Because the pace and the scale of this situation has degraded at a terrifying rate. And honestly, when I look at Britain from afar, sometimes I get scared and I get kind of depressed. Now, and I feel I can say this because we are in the middle of Black History Month, that I think one of the things we need to do is we need to talk about white history. Now, blackness is relentlessly examined and whiteness is always presumed. So people kind of often say, well, don't you think Black History Month is patronizing? And I don't think it's patronizing. I think that, you know, it's the absence in the other 11 months that I find worrying. But what's really difficult for me is the notion that Black history should be racialized and white history should not be, because then Black history becomes like a subgenre of history. Right? You have proper history, and then you have the black stuff. And if Black history can exist, then it follows that you must have white history, that there would be no Nelson Mandela, as we know him, if there hadn't been Henrik Vervoort. There would have been no Rosa Parks. She didn't kick herself off the bus if there had not been Mr. Blake. There may well have been no Notting Hill Carnival had there not been these white riots. And the trouble isn't that we don't hear enough about white history, but that what masquerades as history is more akin to mythology. And we need all the access, we all do, to a path that is accurate, honest, and inclusive. So we don't need more white history, we just need it told better. Because then, perhaps, people could understand the, how much what is going on in the Muslim community is a very, very British experience. It's very much the flesh of our flesh and the blood of our blood. This is not the country's first war on terror. In fact, we've had many, and it would be fair to say that in many ways it's been our default position for the last couple of centuries. People talk about homegrown terrorists as though this is something new, but Britain has been growing its own terrorists for years. In fact, indeed, as long as we have occupied foreign lands, it's been particularly vulnerable to people who would commit acts of violence on our soil. We actually have a whole evening dedicated to terrorism. We call it Guy Fawkes Night. And on that night, we burn a terrorist. We all get around and we burn a terrorist and we eat potatoes. So this is not new. Back in 2001, David Blunkett referred to arranged marriages to foreigners as though they were something alien to British culture. Five of the last six British monarchs in the last century were married to foreigners and all of those unions were arranged. This is nothing new. We know this. Britain has a long history of going to foreign countries and not mixing with local people. Back in 2001, Blunkett called on Muslims to accept our norms as we would if we went elsewhere. As though the Mau Mau, the potato famine, and Ritsar, the Bengal famine, never happened. And about 3 years ago, we come back to David Goodhart, the editor of Prospect, who in his now infamous piece wrote, "We need to be reassured that strangers, especially those from other countries, have the same idea of reciprocity as we do." Well, let's hope not. First of all, I want to know who these strangers in our own country are. Who are they? Who are? How can you have these strangers in your country? Who are these strangers? Why are they so strange? But secondly, let's hope that the people who come from the former empire don't have a system of reciprocity. Because if we do, England's in real trouble. And then they will steal the resources, eradicate the language, thwart the democracy, imprison the leaders, live in isolation, and practice segregation, because that's what Britain has done all over the world until very, very recently. Now, white history does not mean racist history. We could talk about the progressive forces. We could talk about William Wilberforce. We could talk about Trevor Huddleston, Rawney Laslett, the local community leader who teamed up with what was going on with Claudia Jones and took the Notting Hill Carnival forward. We can talk about Cable Street and the Lancashire cotton workers in 1862 who supported the blockade of the southern states during the Civil War to show their detestation at the attempt to organize a nation having slavery as its basis. Because then, if we also include that history, we can see that none of this is inevitable. None of it is inevitable, but there is a way out. That one of the true crimes in all this, and I'll say that there were two. One is how they have made us think that there's no other way to go, there is no other space, when actually I think that right-minded people in this country of all races and all religions are actually in a majority, but we have no leadership. But secondly, and this I truly believe is the way in which our political class has underestimated white people. White people's ability and design to connect. The white people may be the group least likely to integrate, but the truth is that like most of the Muslim community, they are still eager to try and struggling to make sense of how to do it. But their ability to connect with other groups is great. CRE poll in 2002 found the overwhelming majority of British people do not connote Britishness and whiteness, 86%, believe it's right to respect the rights of minorities, 78%, and think British people should do more to learn about other cultures in this country, 57%. And a story from my own life here, that when my parents came to live in Stevenage, they went around a number of places. This was in the late mid-60s. And wherever they went, there was the twitchy curtains and the kind of, you know, it was in the power light era, so it was a rough time. I mean, and in the end, we came to this place in Stevenage, and white lady, Mrs. Silling, came with some milk for my brother and was incredibly welcoming. And that was, in the end, when I thought, oh, we'll stay here. She's nice and it looks like this might be a nice place to live. Now, Mrs. Silling grew up in the East End and moved to Stevenage when Stevenage was created. And one of the things I really remember about her, it was difficult for her. She was quite old, and she had this young family, these three boys would be forgetting our keys, getting in through the window, always a kind of mess and hoo-ha, and the garden was a mess, and she was very kind of kept everything very clean. But she was, we were on famously, and she was incredibly good to us. And I remember, with some affection, Miss Stilling talking to me about the prospect of Hong Kong Chinese people coming to Britain. She was a Daily Mail reader, and she had all sorts of kind of views that, we never went into, but she said, here's the problem for me, she said, is that if they come in, they say, this country's a small country, and if they come in, it will tip up. And Mrs. Stilling honestly believed that Britain would go like this, and all the people who live in Aberdeen would end up being flung into the bottom of the boom of Italy. I tell you no lie. And yet, Mrs. Stilling was a great friend to us, and on a human level, she was a brilliant person. And my point here is that there was potential in Mrs. Stilling. Mrs. Stilling was an anti-racist waiting to happen, and nobody ever asked. Yeah. And there are anti-racists like that all over the country, waiting to be asked, waiting to line up, who feel it, who know it, but I've never, ever given the chance. And I honestly believe that they're exactly the same kind of people for a different cause that can be recruited from the Muslim community. But appealing to racism that exists has always proved far more politically expedient than galvanizing the potential that could be. And what we need in this country is leadership. And for all our sakes, I say if the politicians can't lead, then at least they can do is follow. Because this country is ahead of them when it comes to these issues, but it's being dragged backwards. But too much is at stake to allow this situation to degrade any further. Secondly, we have to recognize and fight for the legitimate grievances of the white working class that create such a pool of resentment. Because these people are as much the flotsam and jetsam of globalization as anybody who's just got off a plane or even come into this country at the bottom of the Eurostar. All the certainties that they once knew and that their parents knew have gone. The work, the retirement, the housing has gone. They look to new labor to provide them with their most basic needs, but instead it appeals to their basis instincts. And they are vulnerable to their own fundamentalism. And they also look at the society that they're asked to integrate into one with low pay or no pay and no social housing and poor education and diminishing welfare state, and they wonder what their place is in that society. And we have to find a way to wade through the tabloid filth and the myths and the scaremongering and make common cause with those people, because if we don't, others will. And they actually are natural allies. And finally, and possibly predictably, we have to stop this war. Because so long as we're committing war crimes in abroad, all this talk of liberal democracy at home is not just irrelevant, it's sordid and it's dishonest. That the war didn't invent fundamentalism in this country, but it's given it a home that continues to grow. And as time goes on, the distinction between the war on terror at home and the war on terror abroad become more and more grey. Now, that was once branded in the left-wing heresy, that there was some connection between what's going on in Iraq and what's going on in Britain or in America, but now it's become an orthodoxy, even for the intelligence service communities. It's become a recruiting sergeant for extremists across the Muslim world. And finally, we have to deal with our foreign policy. I want to end by saying that every time I come back and I hear something like Jack Straw, I always feel like I've landed in the wrong decade. Always depressing. But then whenever I take a walk through the East End or anywhere in London or Manchester or Liverpool or Bristol, I always feel that I'm in the right place at the right time, and I'm glad to be in that place at that time. Now, the mantra of those people who feel reined in by pre-existing parameters is that politics is the art of the possible. But I think that politics must also be about imagining other possibilities. And if we didn't, we wouldn't be here. If we didn't imagine other possibilities, then Claudia Jones would not have done what she did. Now, we have a fight in our hands. There's no doubt about that. When you look back to 1958 and the fight that Claudia Jones waged, and when you look at what came of it and how unlikely that must have seemed at the time, then you can see what's possible. That even in the most improbable moments, we have to carry on fighting for a generation of people who have not yet been named but deserve better. Now, I'm going to end with a poem by M.A. Césaire called Notes from a Return Home. Césaire says at the end of this poem, "For it's not true that man's work is done, that we have no place in this world, that we have to walk in step with the world, for man's work has only just begun. Man has to conquer the forbidden immobilization and the recesses of his fervor. No race has monopoly on beauty, on intelligence, or on strength. And there is a place for us all at the rendezvous of victory." Thanks very much.
Gary, you said that you would talk about black people in prisons and in the mental health system. And it made me think about the ways that different communities integrate or assimilate or whatever in this country. My heritage is Jewish, and in fact, I was born here, but my mother wasn't. She's a Holocaust survivor from Poland. My grandparents on my father's side were from Russia. I'm thinking that there seem to be communities who have threaded themselves in and achieved some success. And I wonder what you have to say about those things here and in America. About the ways that different communities integrate or assimilate.
Well, I suppose I would say two things. First of all, that not everybody's coming from the same kind of. Not everybody's coming. Everybody arrives in the same place, not coming from the same place. So, I used to think I came from the Caribbean, and my parents were from Barbados, and then I went to Jamaica. And then I realized that my parents were from Barbados, and Jamaica was very, very different to Barbados. And the experiences of someone who came from there might not be kind of, would not be the same. So you have to kind of, first of all, look at where people come from. And you secondly have to look at why they come. That it's America being a good example, that two of the three great success stories currently touted in America are Colin Powell, who's Jamaican-American, and Barack Obama, whose dad is Kennedy, and his mother's white. The other one was Condi Rice. And she is touted as being a success story, and on her own terms, she has been a success. They're not our terms, but they are terms. And African Americans have a very different experience of America. They didn't come by choice. They are usually two or three generations away from them. They have a permanently minority experience. My wife, who's African American, her parents were raised without the vote, and only got the vote relatively recently. And so they have a very different experience. And so often people say, well, Colin Powell's black, you know, so why can't, well, it's like, well, you know, there are different ways of being black. So there's that. There's also race, that there are some things to some extent, and of course, the more the anti-Semitism grows, the more it's difficult, but Jewish people can pass if they want. They can pass as being non-Jewish. Black people can't pass as not being I'm trying to make is that there are very, these different kinds of oppression will affect people in different ways. Gay people can also pass, and there's that. Language makes a difference, but also just the racial climate. And I'll give you one example and then round up, is that back in the when I was growing up in the 70s, Afro-Caribbeans were the problem. And people would say, almost the exact antithesis of what they say now. They would say, why can't you be more like the Asians? They don't want to sleep with our daughters. They keep themselves to themselves, they work all the hours God sends, and they've got their own culture and their own language, and they're happy with it. Now, you say, why don't you want to sleep with my daughter? What's wrong with my daughter? Outrageous. And the whole thing has been turned around. And so, kind of, it's... it's always very difficult to know where that blow is coming from. And it's also where the next blow is coming from and who it's going to. And there is that kind of general sense of precarity, which in my experience talking to Jews, and they have, that at any time it could be your time next. That the kind of, the degree to which you feel integrated, the degree to which I have feel integrated, is a precarious one. And so, these things don't stand still, is the other point I would make. And that kind of today's flavor of the month may next week turn the whole thing south. I hope that's some answer.
Say, do you think Labour could have brought in 1997 with their majority that would have made a difference?
Mostly, I would actually say, rather than a policy, it would have been a mood. And the mood would have been one that said, these things aren't going to happen anymore, and that we're a different country in all sorts of ways now, and that incorporated race into that in a kind of it was the one policy commitment at that time that wouldn't have cost them anything to look good, and that I'm not talking about kind of front of house showcase diversity, but of really kind of in a way that, you know, in his way, for all of the problems Clinton did when he first came in, he kind of this is going to be a new way of doing things, and that race would have fit in quite well to that new sense of Britishness, that kind of great May the Second feeling of we're a new country. And instead, they went in the opposite direction, and they committed to go in the opposite direction even before they won. Remember the bulldog that they tried out before the election, and they decided that race would be a key part of the election, and they would be on the wrong side of it. And so that would be the main thing. It wouldn't be something that they, a specific policy, but it would have been a kind of, a definite kind of mood music that they decided not to play. What was good that they did do, although it took some pressure, was the Lawrence Inquiry, and then the McPherson Report, but then they refused to kind of implement most of it. I mean, for the most part, what it felt like they did in the first few years was start a whole load of balls rolling that went in good places. Then as soon as the tabloid reaction came, then they just backed off and disowned it. And so actually many of the things that they started to do, which would have been good, they never followed through on. I mean, I honestly feel when I hear these things about kind of multiculturalism and, you know, government policy, that while they can, and they are, inflaming racism, that the scene that I'm describing in the East End, that's not a product of government policy, apart from immigration. It's the product of a kind of something that they really can't control, just the way that people decide to kind of, you know, interact with each other and to deal with each other. And I also feel that while they can inflame and are inflaming racism now, that they're not going to be able to unpick all of that. So I honestly think that in many cases, and particularly where, unlike America, where you have a codified system of segregation that you can look to reverse, whereas Britain's kind of mess is a lot more difficult to kind of untangle, that that it's not going to be definite policies. It's going to be more piecemeal, and it's going to be more about the things that you kind of evoke, the mood that you evoke. This is not a very satisfying answer, but it's, I mean, that's what I believe.
The question is this. Comparing the British imperialist experience in the colonies and so on, including my own island, Ireland, is it your view that the inability of the British to integrate with the areas that they occupied, unlike the Portuguese and Spanish colonialists, and indeed Dutch, I think, is that reflected in the inability of the British community, or the English community, choosing my language very carefully, but to accept the plethora of cultures that are now around my area in Brent, which is the most multi-ethnic place in the whole of the UK.
See, I think that that's my thing, is that they are playing. There is a racism for them to play to, but actually, we're doing quite well, or we were doing quite well before they started messing the whole thing up. That of all the places that I lived in Paris for a while, and Russia, and I've done a lot of traveling. There aren't many places I would rather live than Britain. And that tells you how bad the other places are. But fascism is a mainstream ideology in most of Europe. It's becoming that now here, but in France it's been like that since 1984. So I kind of think that we're doing, in a way, that's what's so criminal about what's taking place here, is that we have been doing better than most. And I believe that the way in which Britain, what it adds to is the hypocrisy. The way that Britain conducted itself in the colonial area, which was different to other colonists, but wasn't so different to, America and Britain basically got rid of segregation at the same time, more or less. It's just that our segregation was abroad, and so was our civil rights movement. Whereas America had it all on its own turf. And so that kind of aids a kind of historical literacy that I think if we were more literate, all of us, about British history, it would equip us to deal with some of these questions. Because my aim in kind of evoking all that isn't to go into a big British bashing thing, it's to say, look, this is not new. We know about this, we've done this. And actually, we have this conversation with a certain amount of, first of all, accuracy, and secondly, humility. We're going to come to a better place, because while many, many British people, white British people, are not aware of this, there are very few non-white people who are aware of it. That I was raised with this sense of this knowledge of what the flag meant. And it didn't mean, watching the Queen at 3 o'clock on Christmas Day. It meant the flag that was raised over my mother's country that she had to salute even though she didn't agree with it. That's the flag, is the flag of segregation. The Union Jack is not a friendly symbol in much of the rest of the world. But that doesn't mean that we can't move to a better place, or that's the only thing that people think about the British. Do you know what I mean?
I agree with a lot of the stuff you said, but what I wondered is, a lot of those kind of general themes I think could be applied to other countries. And what I wanted to ask you particularly was, as I'm a Canadian, one thing that always never leaves the discussion in Britain seems to be class. So when we talk about integration, whether it's racial integration or actually white integration, in my mind, class is always there. I wanted to know what you perhaps thought about that. And also, having lived abroad a bit, obviously the media in Britain, whether you are even more depressed about the media or whether you think the media is doing actually a good job, or actually discussions that we have here actually make it much worse than it is really on the ground.
I did talk somewhat about class there, and it is it complicates the discussion, but actually in many ways, because at least for the time being, this is the way the British class structure is not particularly fluid one, and that if you're black, you're one generation away from public sector work, basically. Many people's parents, they worked on the buses or the trains or in hospitals or whatever. You're one generation away from low pay, for the most part, if you're kind of around my age. So that's mostly what our parents came to do. And so, to that extent, most black people have here some connection to a working class experience. But it's not the same experience as the white working class. Because it's fractured by race and place. That first of all, you're not fully accepted as being a member of the general working class, and secondly, there is always this harking to another place that you are also from, which is just a regular immigrant experience. What frustrates me here is when people try to bifurcate race and class and say, as our middle class people don't experience, middle class black people don't experience racism, which is daft. One of the ways in which I describe it to in American audiences when they say, well, crudely speaking, where would you rather be? And I usually say, well, I was one of three boys from a single family. My mother was a teacher. We didn't have much money. In America, that would mean that one of us would be in jail, on parole, on drugs, or dead. So I'm glad I was born in Britain. When I got hernia when I was 8, I was taken to the NHS, and I was operated on, and it didn't bankrupt my family. When I got my grades, I could go to university. When my mum died when I was 19, they gave me more money to stay in university. And the Britain, and that was class that got me to that point. That was about being not having much money. But then there comes a point in Britain in which kind of British people, white Britain does not know what to do with you. You've got a degree, we don't know what the hell to do with you. We don't know how to insult you. We don't know, where to move, we don't know what to do. And at that stage, it's easier in America, because in America there is actually a large black middle class, and they're just as horrible as every other middle class. They don't have any kind of great, they're black, but they're kind of rich, and they like their entitlement and all the rest of it. But it does mean that people have heard of you, not you personally, but the possibility. Whereas here, I feel that I'm constantly kind of just, having to kind of, you kick down a door, you repair it, you put it back, and then you finally got to kick it down again the next day. And that is a kind of, that feels like a feature of black middle class or professional class experience. This constant frustration and a low level but persistent casual racism. That if you're the only person in the room can be a very difficult thing to deal with strategically. So hopefully that answers at least some of the questions.
Okay, thanks ever so much.